This is Leilani Ward, and I'm interviewing Larry Gabriel on April 2nd, 2013. Could you tell me something about where you grew up?
I grew up in Detroit, pretty much on the southwest side. And then when I was 11 years old, we moved over near University of Detroit, Livernois, and McNichols area. And then I grew up there until I was 18 and went away to college. But I'm a lifelong Detroiter. I used to live in the Cass Corridor here in the 1970s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I grew up.
What was your family like?
Large family. My family moved to Detroit from New Orleans in 1951. I was the first person in my family born here in Detroit. I was born in 1953. All my older siblings were born in New Orleans. So, you know, I guess we were kind of typical, that northern migration from the South to work at the car factories, and that my father was a musician previous to that, and he traveled around the country, and he was on his way to Cleveland for a music job. And my uncle had moved here and was working at the Rouge plant, at the Ford Rouge plant, the Ford River Rouge plant. He was talking to my father, and it's like, hey, look, you know, you got five kids, you know, you're traveling around the country, half the time you don't even have enough money to send home for the kids, you know, here, stay in Detroit and I'll get you on at the plant. Next morning, he took my dad to the plant, they hired him right on. My dad didn't even make the job in Cleveland. He sent a different bass player to Cleveland to play that job, so that's how we got here to Detroit. And in my family, when I was young, we were culturally a New Orleans family.
Cool. So after high school, where did you go to school?
I went to Michigan State University. I got my bachelor's degree there in 1975. Then I came back and I was a caretaker at the First Unitarian Universalist Church, which is down there at Cass and Forest. I was a caretaker there for a couple of years, and then in 1977, I went to graduate school at Penn State University. I got a master's degree in speech communication. Then I came back to Detroit against their advice. And I resumed working as a caretaker at the Unitarian Church for a few more years. And I think it was 1974, I left there, and I was doing, you know, I'd been doing a lot of small contracting jobs for various church members, and, you know, I was getting to be more and more into that. I was doing painting, carpentry, plastering, roofing, some plumbing work. The only thing I didn't do was electrical work. I was afraid of electricity. I figured if I made a mistake with anything else, you know, it was the repercussions weren't that bad, but, you know, electricity, I could burn down somebody's house or something. So I left that alone, and I wasn't a licensed contractor or anything. And also during that time, I was playing music with my father's band. My father was a bass player and led his own band. It was the Gabriel Brothers New Orleans Jazz Band. And my father had a heart attack around then, and he was playing the bass and singing in the band. And after he had his heart attack, then he would take me on the jobs, and I'd play the bass and he'd sing, so that, it wasn't too hard on him. So I was playing with my father's band around then, and I was playing, I had a couple of little rock bands in the area. And I was also freelance writing for some arts magazines, writing a lot of poetry, that kind of thing. And then, I had this thing that I was doing around then where I would work until I had enough money to go to Mexico for the winter for a couple of months. And so I had been working, actually I was teaching French and Spanish at Benedictine High School. And it was because the teacher who was doing that was pregnant. She'd taken a maternity leave for the first semester. So I taught for the first semester, and then when the semester ended, actually they tried to hire me on permanently, but I was like, no, that's the end of my contract. I'm going to Mexico. So I went to Mexico, and I came back. It was the spring of 1985, and I needed a job. And Metro Times was advertising for a listings editor, you know, the person who does the What's Happening section about all, you know, the bands that are playing or whatever else is going on. So I started working at the Metro Times doing that, and I did that for a couple of years. It was a good job, and, you know, I liked doing it. Then I got a grant from the Michigan Council of the Arts to write a book. Actually, it was a family memoir. It was called Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans Jazz. And so I did that for a couple of years. I did that, and I did other things. You know, I did some more contracting work, and then I started working at the Greystone Jazz Museum. And right in there, my wife got pregnant. And that's, it was like, okay, I got a kid coming. Now I've really got to get a real job. And right around that time, the Metro Times was hiring again. And so I went to work there as managing editor. And so I worked there for a couple of years as managing editor. And one day the phone rang. And it was somebody from the Free Press calling up to ask if I was interested in working at the Free Press. They were looking for an assistant entertainment editor. And it was, a huge raise in pay. And so I went to work at the Free Press in 91, which put me in place to be in the strike in 95. So that's kind of how I got there.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny because my... when I went there in 91, then they were talking about going on strike in 92. There was, I think there was a contract negotiation going on in 92, and they were talking about going on strike. And that was the first time I'd ever been faced with the concept of going on strike. And I talked to my dad, you know, because he was a member of UAW Local 600 for 21, 22 years. And I was like, man, they're talking about going on strike. What'd I do? And Daddy said, stick with the union. So... we didn't go on strike then, but we did go on strike a few years later.
Yeah. So, I just have one more question about your youth. What was it like winning the 1975 Creative Writing Competition in poetry?
Well, you know what? I thought I was going to be a poet. I should have been a poet. I could have been a poet. But, so winning that was like big deal culmination. I was like the best poet at Michigan State University, or, you know, not necessarily, but you know, I had the paper to say it, you know, so that was good. That was great. I still write poetry.
What was your first position at the Detroit Free Press?
Assistant entertainment editor. Okay. It was sort of a halfway between being an editor and a writer. I did a lot of writing. And but I also did some editing too.
Okay. And what was that experience like at the Detroit Free Press? What kind of people did you, and environment did you come into?
Well, I thought it was pretty good. Actually, they treated me pretty well at the Free Press. I came in, and it was the big time. I made it to the big time. I was making good money. I could support my family. I was publishing my writing. They really liked my writing. They promoted me in terms of, like, you know, my visibility in the community, not like a promotion up to a higher job.
Yeah.
I was meeting other people who were good writers in my profession. Actually, the thing that amazed me was that there were some people who were, you know, I'd been seeing their name in the paper for years, who were supposedly, you know, great writers, and I was editing them, and I was finding out that they weren't really that good, you know. So I was surprised at that, you know. I was writing like never before. You know, I was able to write about, I was given a lot of freedom They didn't have a lot of black writers on staff in that, particularly in that department. And part of the reason why they hired me is I'm a Detroiter. I knew Detroit. I was doing a lot of writing about cultural, you know, things in Detroit, and so I was a voice for a segment of black Detroit that nobody had ever paid attention to before. I wrote some big stories about shows at the Museum of African American History. I did a Detroit Black History story. I did a history of WGPR, which was the first black-owned television station in the country. Actually, Richard Nixon gave them their charter back in the 1970s. They have since sold off. They sold off to CBS or something while I was at the Free Press, which is why I wrote that particular history. A lot of jazz musicians I wrote about, black filmmakers and stuff like that. I didn't exclusively write about black stuff, but I was given the free rein to probably 90% of the stuff I wrote was stuff that I came up with. I remember one thing I didn't like writing was that Barbra Streisand went on tour for the first time in who knows how long, and they sent me out to Ticketmaster to talk to people standing in line to buy tickets for the Barbra Streisand concert. And I remember thinking, you know, that's just not something I would have done at the time. But so I met writers. Kim Heron, who was a very good friend of mine, we met in college, actually, in our Journalism 100 class. So it was the first journalism class we were both in. I wanted to be a writer, and I didn't know anything about how you became a writer, so I went to school, and it says, well, journalism, that's about writing, so I went to journalism. He was somebody who'd always wanted to be a journalist, and he was right where he wanted to be. And he was working at the Free Press at the time when I was hired in, so I already had a good friend there. There were very few black guys, and it seemed almost all of them were named Larry. Larry Olmsted was there. There was another Larry Conley was there. And then there was another Larry. I can't remember, but it was like kind of interesting. I thought it was like, all these guys named Larry were at the school. So to me, it was great, man. I got to, they sent me to cover like the jazz festival. So I just spent the whole weekend down at Park Plaza doing stuff that I loved. So it was good working there. I liked it.
Now, did you have time for your music while you were working at the Detroit Free Press?
You know what? I did. I did play music somewhat, but, I made a choice. I made a choice earlier in my life. I was like, well, look, you've been kind of messing around with this music thing. You've been kind of messing around with this writer thing. What's it going to be? You're going to be a musician or a writer? And I knew a lot of musicians who I felt like, they're better than I'm ever going to be, and they're having a hard time making it. And I knew people who were successful writers, working at the newspaper and putting out magazines and winning awards and stuff. And so I felt like I had put in more time and that I was a better writer than I was a musician. So yeah, I was, still dabbling in music, but, that was not what I was trying to make a career out of. And also at that time, it was a hard time in my life because my daughter was born in 89, she died in 92. And so, I became depressed. And actually, when my daughter died, she died in the spring of 92. And then in the January of 93, my half-brother died. 2 weeks to the day later, my brother died. And then I think it got into February, 1 week to the day later, my father died. So I lost four people very close to me in that period of time, so I kind of went off the deep end. And they were good to me about that. They gave me time off work and sent me, told me who to go to get some counseling and that. So, that was a bitter time of my life.
I'm very sorry to hear that. So what are your views on the strike?
The strike, okay, July of 95. First of all, I didn't think it was gonna last that long. I figured we'd be out for a couple of weeks, there'd be negotiations, and we'd go back to work, you know, in a relatively, you know, short period of time. I remember Hugh Granum, who just died a couple months ago, I guess, a photographer, he said, I hoped it would last long enough so I could go visit my mom. His mom lived out on the East Coast or something, and he wanted to go out and see his mom and get back before the strike was over. And actually, I remember thinking, you know, well, I hope I had just moved. It was funny because I had moved a week before the strike hit. I'd taken time off. And I remember my wife had just finished, a year before, my wife had just finished school. She was an occupational therapist, and she'd gone to work. And we'd saved her entire salary for that year. So we could, like, we'd lived in this, you know, a small, crappy house that we'd bought for like $3,500, you know, over on in the Brightmoor neighborhood. It was a, you know, we slept on the living room floor for the first 6 months, and it, like, our Christmas present was that we were able to move into our bedroom. You know, we were fixing up the place, so we lived there for several years, and. Then we was like, we can buy a nice house now. And I remember we were like searching for a mortgage, and you know, I'd gone to there was a union mortgage company, and I was like, hey, I'm looking for a house, and they told, oh, we'll give you a $300,000 mortgage, and you know, other companies were talking like that kind of thing, and we were like, no. It's like, we want to buy a house that if one of us loses our job, we can still pay the mortgage on this place. So we ended up buying in Detroit in the Brightmoor neighborhood, which is near Woodward and 8 Mile. And a week after we moved, I went on strike. And I never went back to that job again. You know, so it was very odd, but it was like we did the smart thing. We didn't lose our house. We still live in that same house right now, 18 years later. So, you know, at first I didn't take it real seriously. My father had been on strike, you know, working at Ford, you know, for all those years. And so I'd seen him on strike before, and the strikes never lasted that long. And, you know, so with that as the model, I thought, okay, you know, there'll be negotiations and then we'll go back. And they refused to negotiate. The other side refused to negotiate. So, you know, it was like I started taking it more seriously a few weeks later. And, but you know what, I didn't want to be regimented. I didn't want to say, you have to be here at this time and pick it for this amount of time and that sort of thing. Which, now that I know, really you do have to do that. You know, I'd show up and pick it down at the Free Press, you know, sometimes. And then they had pickets out at the printing plant, and I'd go show up and pick it there. And, you know, but I didn't really realize what an effort you have to put into being on strike. You know, it's a very serious thing. You know, it's like people's families broke up. You know, people got sick and died. People had to move their families across the country to take other jobs. It's not something you do, you know, on a lark. It's not something you said, okay, well, we're going to strike, and you know, it's a very serious endeavor. And it's something I've learned since then that I really respect people who make that decision to do that, you know, because it's a life changing experience. I never went back and worked at the Free Press again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. Anyways, so I used to go down and pick it at the Free Press. Kim Heron, the guy I was telling you about earlier, the guy who's my good friend.
Yeah.
He used to do regularly picket there, and I remember we were out there picketing one night. We used to picket in the evening together sometimes, and the story came back to me through some people who were inside the building. There was some scab, and they had told him to go out and do something, and he was like, you know, he looked out the window, and me and Kim were out there, and they were like, he was like, oh man, I can't go out there. There's these two big scary black guys out there picketing, you know? And somebody else looked out there and just laughed. Oh, that's Larry and Kim. It's like, what are you scared of them for? So, you know, that was one thing that happened. Another thing that happened actually out near my house is, you know, they were, because there was, you know, boycotts that came on the newspaper, and a lot of people were canceling their subscriptions and that, they started just delivering the paper for free to everybody's porch, and they had these scabs driving around the neighborhood in cars dropping off newspapers. So I remember I had been a block over from my street, and I saw these guys doing it. And I told them, I live on the next street over, this is my address, do not put a news one of those scab papers on my front porch. And, you know, so then I go home, and a little while later they come through, and they're throwing them, and they throw a paper on my porch, and I'm watching. So I run out there, the guy sees me, and they just closed the car and drove off. And I found out later that the guy had gotten scared. He had come in from Oregon or something. He went back to Oregon after I chased him. So, you know, that's kind of what was happening there. Ask me some specific questions or other questions.
How did you feel about the company?
I really began to hate the company after a while, because not only did they refuse to negotiate, they were committing unfair labor practices. And you know, the thing is when you commit an unfair labor practice, you get taken to court, and then all the politics of, you know, well, we're going to postpone this hearing and that hearing. And so they were guilty, and they were found guilty, but it took so long before they were found guilty, it really didn't matter. You know, I mean, we're talking about a year later, 2 years later, when this stuff was coming out. For instance, one time out at the Sterling Heights plant, there was a big picket out at the Sterling Heights plant. And their trucks caught on fire. And they accused the union of burning their trucks. And there was, you know, it was like, you know, television cameras love fire. And the TV cameras were out there, and they're taking pictures of the fire, and they're showing it on TV. And the union, you know, burnt the company's trucks, and blah, 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 they're saying on the news. And then after the Macomb prosecutor did an investigation several months later, and he said, as far as we can tell, these guys burnt their own trucks, which they can do, but they should get a fire permit if they're going to do that. And that was like, you know, this much news on page 25. And it was like, as much as anybody knew, the strikers burnt the trucks. When, after the investigation, it was found that the company burned their own trucks and then blamed it on the strikers. And it was that kind of thing. You know, they're committing unfair labor practices and then, you know, blaming it on the union. And you know, that's kind of how I learned. That's how they do it, you know. They were out to break the union at that point. They weren't out to negotiate a contract. You know, they'd come to the negotiating table and then walk out, and it would be months before you could get them back to the negotiating table. It was terrible. And it taught me, you know, some lessons about, you know, that sort of thing. And then later on I went to work at the UAW. I was editing Solidarity magazine, and I knew exactly what was going on then whenever, you know, people went on strike. And you know, you talk to these workers who've been on strike for like, you know, 18 months, and you know, they don't know which way to turn. And but I could understand that. I could relate to that because I knew how that worked.
And that helped a lot with when in 2002 when you started at Solidarity.
Yeah, that's probably. I mean, well, probably one of the reasons I was hired is because I'd been a newspaper striker. Although I was hired by Steve Jokic when he was president of UAW, and I think the thing that I told him that really, really made the difference was when my father worked at Ford. He worked in the paint shop, and he got a permanent nasal infection from the fumes in the paint shop, and he uh, he had to he sued Ford Motor Company for a medical retirement, because he didn't sue them for like damages and all that, but hey, I want my medical retirement. He wasn't there during the years of the great contracts. The great contracts for big three workers didn't really start until the late 70s. And, he never made more than about $5 an hour at working at the Ford Rouge plant. But anyways, he was suing Ford Motor Company, and he got Ken Cockrell Sr., who was a big civil rights lawyer in Detroit in the 60s. He's the father of our city council member, Ken Cockrell Jr. And Ken Cockrell told him that he was going to have to hold out for 3 years to win this suit, that he would win, but he's going to be able to hold out for 3 years. And the kind of the thing they would do is the Ford Motor Company would get, like, you know, the trial, the hearing postponed, and then they'd come back and they'd offer my father a job in another part of the plant. And, you know, it's like, hey, you know, you've got a family and you're paying a mortgage and, you know, your money's not coming in and they offer you another job, it's a temptation to do it. And but my father didn't, and actually part of the reason that he didn't have to go back is he went back to play music full time, and he was able to bring money in from that. And also I came home from school. I was at Michigan State. I came home from school and got a job, and I was turning my money over to their family for about 4 or 5 months there. And so when I told Steve Jokic that story, he got up and was like, okay. And I was hired at that point. So that it was kind of like I had a background of kind of knowing how labor confrontations worked out, you know. So and you know, they don't, the strike's not over in 2 weeks or 4 weeks necessarily. And that's the other thing that I really learned about from the newspaper strike is if you're going to go on strike, you have to stop the other side from making money. Okay, you've got to stop production. If they can go on making money with scab workers, you know what? They have no reason to negotiate with you. And the other thing I learned was that you can't, in the era of corporations where your home office is somewhere else, you can't shame them. You know, maybe if this was a family-owned company who lived locally, maybe they could be shamed, you know, into negotiating with you. You can't shame a faceless, nameless, faceless corporation. You know, they're out to make money. That's their goal. You know, we got some people to drop, you know, to drop their subscriptions. You know, we were working on a advertiser boycott. I'm sure they lost some advertising, but they were able to keep coming out every day. And you know, I know some of the people on my street, my neighbors. I saw the deliveries come into their house. So if you can't stop production, you're in a bad way when it comes to striking. You know, they knew they were going to force a strike. They were ready for the strike. They had their scabs lined up. And actually, when I look back on it, for about the last year before the strike happened, they were hiring a lot of people from like right-to-work states. People who were not particularly union-oriented, so that when the strike hit, they were like, hey, I'm back to work. I ain't going for this strike stuff. They were new in town. They weren't settled in. They had to get their paychecks. And they were not particularly, you know, favorable of unions. So that's something else that happened. Now, at the same time, I think the union itself wasn't real ready for a strike at the time. I think the union was kind of like me, yeah, they're going to negotiate it and we'll be back, you know, in a few weeks or, you know, a month or something. And the union did not, and certainly me individually, had not educated me as to what this was all about and what it was going to take. I you know, and that's kind of funny because I was one of the few people who would show up at union meetings, you know, like 2 years before the strike, you know, the union would have some meeting or something. And I'd go to a meeting, there'd be like, you know, 3-4 people there. But I was not full on ready and knowing what to expect when that happened. And then the other thing that happened was there was like, you know, after the strike happened, there were huge union meetings, and people in the union were fighting with each other over what the tactics should be and what we should be doing, and, you know, and that very much turned me off, you know. I was like, hey, we're supposed to be together in solidarity here, and these guys are fighting with each other at the meeting, taking up all the time fighting with each other instead of us being able to talk through, you know.
So you think there should... I'm sorry.
So you think that
there should have been more consistency in training, letting people know how the strike was going to take place, and more making sure that there's... understanding with everybody?
Yeah. I think the union could have done that. Now, there was people in there who'd been, like, you know, political and labor activists and that, but, you know, they had different ideas about what you should do and how you should do this. And, you know, part of it was this thing of, you don't want to do anything illegal, you know, because then, you know, hey, you know, you lose face in the community and they can, you know, charge you with things that, you know, for doing things that were illegal. But if you can't stop, you know, but if you can't stop production, which you have to do something illegal to stop production. And that was part of that was the big fight. People were fighting about we should be more radical. It was like, no, we have to follow the rules, you know. So, you know, in the end, we pretty much followed the rules. But, you know, that was a bone of contention. And you know what? Like I said, they can just keep on making money and going to the bank. They have no impetus to negotiate with you.
Yeah. So what was it like on the picket line?
The picket is according to, like, you know, like picketing, like out in front of the Free Press at night was pretty uneventful. There weren't a lot of people there, but we were just picketing to maintain the picket there. Then there would be like focused pickets where it's like, okay, we're going to get a lot of people out here. And that was really great because you were with your coworkers and there was solidarity. And, you know, if you were feeling down, you know, that, you know, there was problems that, you know, your coworkers could pick you up, you know. And, you know, that was great. You'd hear, you know, the speeches that, you know, that reminded you that you were in the right, you know. So those were really great, and you know, like I say, when they had the big pickets, it was very very much a sense of solidarity and sometimes of celebration. Now there was also pickets down at the riverfront plant. Those were the most confrontational pickets because that was the actual attempt to stop production if they couldn't get the papers out from the printing plant. So what would happen would be like, you know, the police would let us block it for a while and then they'd clear us. And it's like, I remember being down there and the police were on horses and they rode on the picket line with horses. And man, those horses are scary. You're standing there, you're holding your ground, and those horses are just walking on you, man. It's just like, broke up the picket line. Now there was other times when we'd be blocking the gate and they'd be coming out of the plant on trucks, and they'd be acting like they were going to run you over. I knew the trucks weren't going to run me over, and I could stand there, and I knew they were going to stop. Or if they ran me over, you know, they were going to be in the wrong. Those horses, man, those horses don't know who the hell you are, you know? And I was more scared of the horses. But, you know, I remember standing out there in front of the gate when the trucks would be coming up, and the union leaders who weren't there, you know, there was, I think there was three different unions involved. There was the newspaper workers, and then there was the Teamsters, who were like the truck drivers and that, and then there was the clerical people. And then there was like the AFL-CIO guys who were like, you know, we're dealing with the group. So one of the big honchos, they would, you know, they'd be out there, and we'd be in front of the trucks. And we'd block them a few times, then they say, okay, we made our point, let's get out of the way, because it was actually illegal to do that, and they let us do it for a while, and then the union leaders would say, okay, let them out, you know, and I was like, hey, I'm going to stand here, you know, but it was like, it was illegal, and it was like, no, you're going to get arrested, and then the union's going to get cited for RICO or racketeering or something, and so we have to let them do that, but, you know, that happened out at the Riverfront plant, too. It was pretty wild sometimes, you know. Like I said, those horses were scary, man. I did that, and the horses are big. You don't really realize that until you're standing in front of one and they're looking like they're getting ready to step on you. It's like, man, those suck. They use big horses.
Yeah. So lost my spot. So did you enjoy the support that you got from the other unions?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, when you're out there, it's always great to know that, you know, somebody else supports you. The UAW came out and supported us. You know, and it makes me when I see other people on strike or picketing, you know, I give them whatever support I can give to them at that time. And sometimes it's just blow your horn in support. Sometimes it's like, hey, I got a couple hours, I'll come out here and stand on the picket line with you for a couple hours. You know, there was people who would just show up at the picket line and they'd have like a basket full of like hot dogs on buns or bologna sandwiches or something. And it's like, hey, I just wanted to bring you guys some food to eat. You're out here on the picket line. So that was very cool. You know, it was always great when you were out there picketing and people start beeping in support of you, you know, because, hey, you feel alone, you know. And when you're out there, you know, in front of the Free Press and they got their security guards, you know, and they're bringing the scabs in on trucks and with their security guards around them, and you're like, you know, I actually had a security. Here's another thing that happened. The Free Press, during the months coming up to the strike, they were having construction on one of their floors. And it's like, oh, we're fixing this place up, don't go in there. And as it turned out, they were building barracks for their security guards to live in the building when they forced the strike. And one of the security guard guys came out there and he was talking to us on the picket line one day and he was like, yeah, you guys are getting screwed. They're just fucking you over. And it's like, so, well, why are you helping them? Well, I'm from out of state and I need a job, you know. But, you know, they did. They built a barracks for the security inside the Free Press building so that these guys could live there and, you know, and protect the people that they were bringing in on trucks and that sort of thing. And, you know, so that's, you know, that was pretty weird. And then, you know, you see people that used to be working with, you know, who were your friends, who they're going into work, and you're like sitting there and it's like, you know, hey, I'm not making any money. You know, well, strike pay was not that much. But, you know, it's like, it was tough being out on strike.
So, I understand that you have very strong feelings up towards those strikers who crossed the picket lines.
Well, you know what? I did, but... And, you know, some people, it's a little more than others, but you know what? It's been 18 years from the strike. I carried that in my heart for a long time, well over a decade. And in my life, I've just been trying to let go of the negative things, just for my own growth as a person and to be able to... you know, live my life and live a good life. And I've been letting go of some of that stuff. So there are people that I've just, you know what, they're not worth me putting the energy into hating. You know, I read the Free Press now, mostly online. I don't like to give them my money. But, and I won't get a subscription to them because I don't want my name on their list. But, and you know what, I'm not going to like be overly friendly to people who cross the picket line, but I don't carry that in my heart anymore. And I don't carry that, you know, I used to like, you know, I'd see a newspaper box, you know, and you know, it's like, it's not good for you to walk around like that and carry that negativity in your heart. So I have, and most of the people that work there now weren't around then. You know, they're people who, you know, 5 years ago, you know, got a job at the Free Press. So what do they have to do with the strike? You know, it was like the strike was long over when they came. Actually, there's a guy who's an editor there right now. My daughter, I got a daughter who was born in 97. She's 15 now. My daughter and his daughter go to school together, and they're like best friends. So, I mean, it's like, I don't want to tell my daughter, you can't go over their house because of something that happened, you know, years before you were born, you know. And there, the other deal is that, you know, there's few enough friends available anyway. When I was a little kid, you know, there's like 40 kids on the block, you know. We'd have mega, you know, kick the can and tag and all that games. Now it's like, hey, there's like maybe 5 kids on the block and is one of them your age, you know. So, you know, it's my, so my daughter plays with, you know, with his kid, and then I don't, you know, I talk to him. We're not super friendly. It's just like, hey, our kids play together. But, you know, hey, you know, there's nothing antagonistic going on between us. And so, yeah, it's been 18 years. And I know there's other people who still carry, you know, a very hard heart towards, you know, people. You know, it's hard when somebody who was maybe, you know, close to you, used to go out and have lunch together, and then you're on the opposite sides of the picket line, you know. And I'm trying to think. I don't really, you know, I don't hang out with any of them now, but if I see somebody, you know, out on the street, if I'm out at Noel night and somebody walks by, I'll say hi to them, you know, that kind of thing. There's this one guy, Luther Keith. He was working at the news at the time, and I don't think he was in the union. I think he was in management. But I don't even know how much of how true it is that he got a striker fired. He was crossing the picket line to go to work, and somebody from the picket line yelled something at him that he said was a threat. And so, you know, he reported him and said, I feel, you know, I feel threatened for my safety, and the striker was fired. And I don't know that is particularly all true, but that's the story that mm-hmm. was circulating around. And so, and Luther Keith is also a musician. He's a blues musician. He's got a band, and he calls himself Luther Bandman Keith. Well, so I felt animosity towards Luther for a long time. Well, Luther runs this nonprofit now called Arise Detroit, and he's working with community organizations to help, you know, save Detroit. And he's been doing that for a long time. So I've decided, you know what, if Luther has done something bad, he has, you know, made up for it. And I deal with Luther. You know, when Arise Detroit has their big, you know, Detroit, you know, community organization celebrations and that, I'll do something for Arise Detroit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it's something that I've been coming around with the last few years of my life. It's just that, you know what, I'm 60 years old. I want to have peace in my life. I want to exude goodness. I don't want to carry that negativity around with me. So I don't do that anymore. I did used to do it, though.
It seems like you're doing good with that. do you have any, do you recall any memories from the community's reaction to the strikers?
Yeah. You know, it's like, I like I said, I moved to my new house right before the strike. And so I'm on strike. I got a sign out in front of my house. One day, very early on, one of my new neighbors came and knocked on the door and handed me $20. And I was like, you're on strike, I know it, you can use this money. Another one of my neighbors down the street, who I didn't know, you know, came down and knocked on my door and handed me some money. And so I thought that was pretty amazing. And, you know, I'm a new neighbor. They don't know me. They just know that I'm a striker. And they know I need some support. And they did that. That was very amazing.
Was all the community response positive?
You know, I don't recall much in the way of negative response, except for this guy. I had just moved, and so then I was selling my old house. And this guy who bought houses cheap and rented them out, like he owned, like, you know, I don't know, 60 houses in the neighborhood. And I was talking to him, and I was like, hey, I'm a newspaper striker. And he, like, went off on it. That's communism and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I used to have a machine shop, and those guys organized. And I closed the place down because I wasn't going to, like, you know, have no union at my place. But in general, I'd talk to people, you know. I'd go into stores, and I'd say to them, like, you know, hey, you're selling the scab paper here. And some of them, like, you know, stop selling the paper. Some of them wouldn't, but they wouldn't give me negative. They would just, like, you know, some of my customers are, you know, want the paper, and, you know, I'm providing them a service. But by and large, the community helped. You know, there was a lot of religious leaders who came out in support of us. I would say, actually, the community support, as far as, you know, that coming out and saying, you know, we support the union and that the newspaper should come to the bargaining table, was all on our side. was certainly, you know, at least 90% on our side. And the only, you know what, the only company that I can remember that kept doing business with them that was Focus Hope. And Focus Hope is a community organization, and they do a lot of training of workers to go into, like, industrial work. Focus Hope they had some type of thing that they did with the paper every year, and they kept doing it. And I was very surprised and disappointed with Focus Hope when they did that.
Yeah.
But by and large, the community was very much in support of us. But I would say that the days of the community support doesn't matter to these corporations that have shareholders who aren't in your community and they're somewhere else and they just want to make their money.
Yeah. They do. The Detroit Metro Times hired you in January of 1997. Tell me something about that.
Well, I'd already worked for them twice before.
Yeah.
And actually, excuse me, while I was at the Free Press, probably about 2 years in, they offered me the job as editor of Metro Times, and I accepted it. And I went to quit at the Free Press, and they said, wait a minute, what's it going to take to keep you here? And so I ended up staying at the Free Press because I got a huge raise. And I told them I don't want to be an editor anymore, I just want to be a writer. So they made me a writer. So that's why I ended up staying at the Free Press at that point in time. However, what happened was the fall of 96, my wife got pregnant. And I was working, what was I doing then? I can't even remember where I was working then or what I was doing. I was just doing some, you know, some light contracting work. And so my wife got pregnant and it's like, well, I need a regular paycheck. There was an opening at the Metro Times for managing editor. So I went back as managing editor again. And then about 3 months after that, I became editor. And so that's kind of why I went back to the Metro Times. I've worked for the Metro Times on 4 different occasions in my life. So I've got a good relationship with them. And when I left there, like, you know, back in, like, 1987, it was just kind of like, yeah, we know we can't pay you much money, and, you know, you got this other good opportunity, fine, you know, shake your hand and pat you on the back and, you know, maintain that relationship. So I went back in 97. It was like going back home for me. And I was able to hire a couple of people who were strikers. Kim Heron, when I became editor, I hired him as my managing editor. I was able to hire Emily Everett, who was a copy editor at the Free Press. I hired her as a copy editor at the Metro Times. So I was able to help a couple of strikers when I went there. And, it was good. As a matter of fact, by the time the strike was over and the Metro and the Free Press called me back, I was like, hey, you know, I'm editor at the Metro Times and I'm making good money. I don't need to come back.
What was it like to cover your fellow workers during the strike?
It was just normal. You know, those were the people I was dealing with, and, you know, I personally didn't cover them. I had other people covering them, because I mean, just in terms of journalistic integrity, it's you know, what is it, you know, conflict of interest kind of thing. But also, you know, I kind of had to walk a you know, I had to stay on the path there, because my boss, he was not a slam dunk union guy. He was definitely a progressive guy, but he had broken a union organization organizing drive at the Metro Times before I ever worked there in the first place. Back in like 1983 or 84, there was people organizing. He fired them all.
Okay. Really?
I didn't know this at the time when I first went to the Metro Times. But I learned that later on. But I also was not, the only union I was in at that time was the musicians union, and the musicians union doesn't do a lot of you know, of labor organizing in that, you know, it's not a hardcore labor organization, so to speak.
So,
you know, the musicians union, they, like, you know, they do a lot of work for, like for instance, the symphony organization.
Yeah.
But just a freelance musician out there playing the gig once in a while, there's not a lot they can do for you. You know, they're not negotiating contracts, you know, with employers. They do have rates, and you know, if I get a job, I write out the contract and take it into the union myself. But, you know, every time you get a job, they're not out there negotiating the contract for you. You know, not the way, you know, you do at, you know, big established places. But, so anyways, my consciousness, my labor consciousness developed later on. But in 1985, I was, you know, hey, I'm just back from Mexico. I need a job. I don't know that I'm going to be working at for the Metro Times, you know, 25 years later.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Sort of like you start dating somebody, you know, you're going to be married and, you know, 35 years later, you're still together and got kids and all that sort of thing. So anyways, yeah, it was strange, but I felt like I came at it with more sympathy towards the union than the previous editor had been. So I thought that they were, you know what, and this is something, you know, they were objective, and I was not objective. You know, I had a point of view, so that was the difference. But I had to become more objective as the editor of the Metro Times.
Just one last question. Do you think that the newspaper strike has affected your life today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I had the newspaper not gone on strike, I could well still be working, still working there now. You know, and one of the things that the newspaper does, the dailies do well, is when they decide they're going to promote a personality, they do that. And you know, you see, you know, hey, there's that person's picture on the card on the front of the newspaper box. There's that person's picture up on a billboard. There's that person in a commercial. They're promoting them, and nobody else I've worked for does that. So I feel like I probably, had I stayed at the Free Press, and at the time I was talking to my bosses about becoming a columnist, I probably would be much more of a celebrity in Detroit, because they promote you that way. At the Metro Times, they're not sophisticated in that way. And they had not quite gotten to the point where, you know, well, we're cross-promoting with, you know, we're going to do this this thing with the radio station every week, and they're going to interview the editor of the Metro Times about what's in the Metro Times or anything like that. And we were just first starting to get into the internet stuff at that point in time. So, you know, I feel like I would probably still be working there. I'd probably be making a fair wage. Although now that I think about it, I know like they've been downsizing and downsizing, and people don't make the kind of money they used to make unless you're Mitch Albom. But you know, I feel like, you know, it's kind of like when you have that financial space in your life where for a year and a half I didn't make money, you never recover from that financially. You know, that's just money that you didn't make, and you know, interest that you didn't get, or investments that you weren't able to make, or whatever, that you just, that's just gone. You know, you know, it made my life different in terms of people who I would talk to and not talk to. I made a lot of friends due to being on strike. You know, people that I probably hadn't talked to that much, but because we were co-strikers, you know, we did. I know, like I said, I know people who, like, you know, got divorced or had to move their families out of town. It's there are points in your life where, you know, this is a, when looking back, you know, this was a life-changing event, and this was a life-changing event. You know, I had gotten more into writing, and then I had to get back into editing. I'm a writer. I love writing. That's why I'm a freelancer now, because I don't like editing. I don't like having to be in charge of other people in terms of, oh, you didn't do this right, you know, that kind of thing. I feel like I do what I do. I do my stuff well. I don't want to worry about, you know, whether you and your wife had an argument and you got to work late, or, you know, I don't want to have to coordinate the writer and the photographer or the artist and, you know, dealing with, you know, the lawyers and all that. I'm a writer. I want to write. That's what I do. That's what I do well. That's what I take joy in doing. So I could have probably continued writing there, and I had to get into doing the editing thing again.
Thank you. You're a very interesting man, and I really appreciate the interview.
Thank you.